Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In this hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, the stock market yesterday had its largest intraday point drop ever, despite strong economic data that was released last week. Increasing volatility is the norm. What accounts for the volatility? We'll take a look at the underlying reasons. Next, an internal audit of the Defense Logistics Agency, that's the Pentagon, or a division of the Pentagon, by the Big Four accounting firm of Ernst & Young, found that the Pentagon failed to keep track of nearly $800 million that it now cannot account for. The auditors said across the board, the agency's financial leadership is so weak that it is simply unable to account for this money.
And in our second hour, we talk about the five big stories of the day. First, a British court has upheld an arrest warrant for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, rejecting arguments that the warrant is moot because Assange is no longer wanted for questioning in Sweden. Next, Senators John McCain, a Republican, and Chris Coons, a Democrat, have come up with a bipartisan immigration bill that they believe will be attractive to both parties. The White House, though, has already rejected it. But will it still be the basis for real immigration reform? Then, the government is set to run out of money again at the end of the week, while Congress scrambles to come up with another continuing resolution. Observers say that the Democrats will not move to shut down the government and instead will seek a standalone bill to address immigration rather than tying it to the budget. And then, the Trump administration is continuing its internal deliberations over what it euphemistically calls a bloody nose policy for North Korea. In fact, it's a policy to attack North Korea militarily. At the same time, Victor Cha, a Bush administration official and Georgetown University professor whom Trump had named as ambassador to South Korea, had his nomination withdrawn after saying that the policy was a bad idea. Meanwhile, a group of Democratic senators have published an open letter saying that the president does not have congressional authority to launch any strike on North Korea. And finally, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has signaled his support for a coup in Venezuela, praising the history of military rule in Latin America and calling the armed forces an agent of change. That's all starting next on Loud and Clear.
But first, we turn to the stock market. We are joined by Daniel Sankey. We're talking to him from San Francisco. He is a financial policy analyst. And we're joined from Amsterdam by Steve Keen, the author of Debunking Economics and the world's first crowdfunded economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/Prof. Steve Keen. Welcome, Steve, and welcome, Daniel.
Good to be here.
Daniel Sankey, let's start with you. The stock market went up today. Yesterday, it went way, way down. Friday, it went way, way down. Very volatile. Of course, volatility is perhaps the greatest nemesis of all for investors or for the big banks. What's your take?
Yeah, what we're seeing today with a kind of slight uptick, which in no way erases the significant losses over the last previous days, it's a kind of buying on the low point that some investors are trying to take advantage of a temporary or potentially temporary depression in prices. So they're trying to take advantage of that. So what we're seeing is them take advantage of this temporary dip in prices and try to buy some things on the cheap. But I agree that we're going to see more and more volatility. So much of this recent rally in the last year or so has been predicated on a continuing policy of quantitative easing and record low interest rates, which is sort of an artificial way of bowing up the economy and inflating its value, which is what we're seeing in the stock prices. So their values were and continue to be really disconnected from what we might call the real economy, you know, people's wages, their job security, their benefits they're receiving, and also just our general productivity, our ability to create commodities that people want, that people are willing to pay for. It's becoming more and more disconnected from that, more and more financialized, more and more about speculative investing. And that's where the volatility comes in, because it's less tied to kind of real world concrete events.
And that's really the bottom line here, isn't it, Steve Keen? We can have a healthy and robust economy and a stock market that doesn't necessarily reflect it. If we look back on Friday, We had a great jobs report. Unemployment is still low, very low, 4.1%. But that doesn't necessarily mean that stocks are a buy. The stocks can still be inflated and will need to naturally correct. Isn't that true?
Well, your stocks are completely out of kilter with the real economy. And this time, most of the time, it's just speculative excess and exuberance and excessive leverage by the private sector that gives you massive overvaluations. That was certainly the case in 1929. It was also clearly the case in 2000. But this particular bubble has been driven by the Federal Reserve because it's purchased bonds off financial institutions to an enormous scale, $1 trillion a year worth in America since pretty much 2010. And that has effectively meant that $1 trillion worth of cash that's been created for the financial sector has gone across to the stock market. So what we have now is, in fact, is the second highest level of overvaluation of stocks in the history of American capitalism, higher than 1929 before the stock market bubble burst back then. The only peak that exceeds it, if you look at the what's called the cyclically adjusted price to earnings ratio, which Robert Shiller developed, the only one that exceeds it is 2000. So we have a level of stocks right now, when you look at the ratio of the price of stocks to the earnings, it's literally twice the long-term average.
You know, I'm looking at Bloomberg right now, Brian, and there are two articles posted just a few minutes ago. One says, Goldman Sachs says it's time to buy. And then just underneath that, it says, Carl Icahn says market turn is rumbling of earthquake ahead. So even on Wall Street, they can't make up their minds here. But as Steve Keen points out, prices to earnings are exceedingly high, probably double or almost double what they have been historically. And the market is just too expensive.
Daniel Sankey, jump in if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what we're seeing, too, is a lot of methods by which these stocks are inflated in value, which is really becoming a normal course of business. And rather than, you know, build real economy, real jobs, real sectors, it's really a lot of speculation and gambling. I think I'd like to point to especially stock buybacks, where companies, rather than, you know, investing in something that might produce real commodities for sale and thus necessitate jobs and further real-world implications, just buy back their own stocks from investors, essentially transfer the cash they have on hand to investors, which they like very much, which has the added bonus of inflating stock prices. And we're seeing this more and more, especially given the Republican tax plan, which is going to allow a lot of these corporations to repatriate their funds, so bring billions of dollars back home to the U.S., which then they're going to use a large portion of that not to invest in the economy or jobs, but to purchase their stocks back and artificially inflate the price. Because really, at the end of the day, that's the name of the game. Whether you're Apple or Chase or General Motors, your stock price is what you live and die over. And if you can engage in these buybacks to further inflate the price, well, that's what your investors can expect you to do. And that's what we can imagine they're going to do.
That's the voice of Daniel Sankey. He's a financial policy analyst in the Bay Area. We're also talking from Amsterdam with Steve Keen, the author of Debunking Economics and the World's First Crowdfunded Economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/Prof. Steve Keen. Steve, you know, when average people were told that the government was going to use whatever tools it had at its disposal to save at least some of the, well, biggest banks in America, that was, you know, giving them basically cash, about $660 billion, and then perhaps $7 trillion in loan guarantees. And then years now of quantitative easing, whereby the federal government basically inserted itself and brought money to the banks. All of that money, you know, there was no strings attached. There was no real requirement for the banks to do anything in particular with this cheap money or free money. But the expectation from average people would be that, and this was the explanation given to them by the politicians, is that the companies would take that money, they would invest that money, it would stimulate the economy, people would come back to work, the wages would eventually go up as the unemployment reserve army of the unemployed would shrink as a consequence of more people working. There are some indications that wages have gone up slightly, but not much in the last few months. What's the real reason that the corporations and the banks are not using this cheap money to invest in the real economy? Why are they using it to gamble in this casino called the stock market?
Well, because the casino has been driven up by the money pouring in from the Federal Reserve in the first place. So you're in a hiding to nothing until you get to these ludicrous levels of overvaluation to make money on a rising market. And this extremely low volatility before this explosion began was a bit of a giveaway that something had to break at some point. But with that money pouring in, you make money out of shares, rising prices. You make money by buying your own shares and cancelling them and increasing your share price that way and then getting a bonus because your pay is related to share prices if you're a manager of one of these corporations. But you wouldn't be silly enough to invest because aggregate demand is extremely low. Now, what you should really be, what the central bank should have really been doing, and the government should have been doing as well, is boosting aggregate demand. And a major way to do that would be to cut private debt levels. But frankly, and particularly the Federal Reserve, along with the Reserve Bank of Australia, they haven't got a clue how the monetary system functions. And they actually expect that by pouring all this money into banks through buying the bonds off them, they'll lend out the money using a money multiplier. Their own research has shown that doesn't work. And the research of the Bank of England says banks can't lend reserves to begin with. So you've got a bunch of incompetent managers on the ship at the Titanic wondering why it's sinking.
Well, let me just ask you a quick follow-up question, and the same one back to Daniel Sankey. If the commodity markets are glutted, if there's overproduction, in other words, if they produce more, they won't be able to sell them or sell new products at a profit because of that. If that's the restraint, the real restraint, one is there's a lot of incentive to get this super abundance as a consequence of, you know, just using cheap money to drive up and then profit from inflated stock prices. But then the other thing, the negative side of this is if they use the money for production, I mean, for investment in real commodities, and if those commodities don't sell because the markets are already glutted, it seems like an intractable problem. And as a consequence, what could the government actually do? You're suggesting this other way, but none of the governments, at least in the Western world, seem to be keen to do that.
Well, it's partly what Sandra Navidi talks about in her book Superhubs. They're not really trying to manage the economy. They're trying to manage the networks to which they belong, and those networks are fundamentally a nexus of politicians with financiers. And in that nexus, their behaviors, I think they've got to rescue their network, which means you've got to make sure the financial companies, institutions don't fail, and the financial institutions in return end up funding your re-election campaign. So it's an elite trying to maintain an elite when neither part actually understands the system they're in. This has been a classic story of human existence, unfortunately, since right back with the pharaohs, and it's one reason these systems ultimately fail.
Well, Daniel, let me then go back to you. It seems to me, and I'm not an economist, but just from a layperson's point of view, if markets are glutted, if there's an overproduction of commodities, more commodities than can be sold at a profit, the real problem that we're experiencing as an economy is not the problem of scarcity, it's the problem of surplus. In other words, a surplus that can't be easily disposed, and that leads thus to speculation, and the stock market is a good place for it. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly the case. I think one of the things that we're seeing right now and have been for the last 40 years or so is a transformation of our economy from the sort of factory-based productive economy to a financial-based economy. And, you know, when we talk about policymakers who don't understand monetary policy or stupid or incompetent, certainly there's some of that. I think the reality is there's a tremendous amount of money and power that's going into having them make decisions that benefit this financial speculation versus benefiting working people and increasing aggregate demand. Because at this point, I think what essentially these companies are realizing is it's far more profitable, for example, to speculate on derivatives in the foreign exchange market than it is to open a factory. And so what you're seeing is policymakers that are being, you know, elevated to that rank through lobbying and through generous donations by financial institutions who are going to make those decisions that prioritize those financial institutions' needs through quantitative easing, through regulations that are friendly and minimal, versus trying to stimulate aggregate demand, trying to increase wage, trying to increase the ability for working people to benefit and buy, which in turn benefits institutions, because frankly, that model isn't profitable like it used to be. Now the model of gambling, where massive multi-trillion dollar corporations shift funds around from one to the other through complex financial instruments, is the name of the game. It's far faster, it's far more profitable, and those institutions are going to make sure that policymakers continue to push agendas that encourage this type of economy versus a more traditional productive economy.
At the beginning of every economic cycle, the boom-bust cycle, credit is easy, credit is cheap, and that stimulates the beginning or the resumption, the overcoming of the previous recession. Credit, as we can see, has been very, very cheap.
Yes, I mean, for a very long time.
It's been since 2008. How is credit right now, Steve Keen? Is credit tightening?
It's slowing down. Before the boom, it came to an end in 2007, the annual change in debt, which is credit, was running at about 15% of GDP. During the crunch, it dropped to about minus 6%. It's now running at about plus 7%, but that's literally half the scale that credit was before the crisis exploded. And it's already seems to be heading back down again. So credit-based demand has stimulated the economy for a while. But because America is still covering historically such a huge level of private debt, there's not much impetus for credit to continue. So it can start petering out. It appears to be doing that right now.
Hey, I'm looking at a quote from Evan Brown. He's a New York-based director of asset allocation at UBS Asset Management. He told the Wall Street Journal that he's not worried about any of the fundamentals. He said here, the underlying strength of the economy is still healthy. Bull markets end when economies go into recession, not because of high valuations. There's nothing on the horizon to suggest the economy is on anything but stable ground. Violent fluctuations, however painful, happen, but history shows that the fundamentals ultimately prevail. Daniel, I'd like to hear from both of you, starting with Daniel. Would you agree with that? Are we really fundamentally sound, or are we headed for economic trouble?
I think that the truth is we're far less sound than what the commentator was saying. I think that his statements don't take into account a tremendous amount of vital factors in our economy. I mean, on a previous show, we talked about how real wages essentially remained stagnant for the last year and then jumped up about 2-3% in the last 2 months, which
yes,
is nothing. We also talk about how, you know, part-time work and working multiple part-time jobs with little to no benefits is kind of business as usual. It's a standard part of the retail sector. And we also know that, you know, some of these companies are dependent on these extremely cheap goods produced by super exploited labor abroad because no one can afford anything more. No one can afford anything more significant. All these things are really important economic factors that figure into health of the economy, and it's simply kind of become normalized. Whereas 20 years ago, it would be considered kind of disastrous and a huge problem. It's now sort of business as usual. So much of this market and so much of the speculation is driven up by policy as opposed to real economy and real economic strength, and therefore doesn't really have a leg to stand on. So I think whether you're looking at the fundamentals or the day-to-day fluctuations of the stock market, there's not a whole lot of good news to be looked at. There's not a whole lot of solid ground to be standing on.
So Steve Keen,
frankly, the commentary was overplaying.
Steve Keen, would you agree that the problem is with policy, not with the actual economics behind it?
Oh, it's both. I mean, the whole cause of the bubble was an explosion in private debt, which started right in 1945, taking private debt from about 35% of GDP to 170% of GDP. And then the burst of that to 150% is what caused the downturn. Now it's reviving a bit, but you've got an economy trying to revive when it's carrying a private debt load equivalent to 1.5 years worth of output. Now, that is like trying to run 100 meters with a lead weight around your ankles. And you might get moving, but you know, you're not going to have much momentum. And that's what's happening right now. As I said back in Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis? This is repeating exactly the same mistake that Japan made in 1990. And by not removing that ankle, by not removing the level of private debt, the economy will never reach much of a head of steam. So it's fragility at the economic level caused by finance as well as policy paralysis.
I want to help the lay audience understand some of these terms because, of course, people's eyes start to glaze over And they think, well, I don't know all these terms. I don't know the definitions. I don't know how the system really works. Although when you break it down, it's actually not that complicated, even though, you know, financial or economic discussion sounds like a different language. The most common forms of private debt, I think, Steve Keenan, correct me if I'm wrong, or Daniel, are credit card debt or payday loans or other consumer finance, all of which have an interest rate, which we, in exchange for getting the credit, we pay an interest on them. There was, I think 70% of the economy, if I'm not mistaken, is based on consumer spending. So personal debt, and that personal debt is both used to buy things that individuals or families use, or also to finance housing in particular. What happens there makes a big difference. So how much, let's start with you, Steve, since you have focused on this. How much of the, you're saying that it was 170% personal debt was equivalent to 170% of the gross domestic or gross national product for a whole year?
No, yeah, household debt is about 80% mortgage debt and 20% credit card and short-term loans and stuff like that. And that also reached about 100% of GDP back in 2007. So household debt, or all household debt put together, was roughly equivalent to 1 year's entire GDP for the country. And at the same time, the corporate sector had long-term debt borrowed from banks of about 70% of GDP. Now, if you go back to the 1945, the sum of both of them was about 35% of GDP. So in that sense, America's carrying five times as much debt as it did during its golden era.
Yeah. So Daniel Sankey, the chronic problem of overproduction where corporations produce blindly for a market, not knowing for sure that they'll sell their products. And at a certain point, the market becomes glutted. They've produced more than can be sold at a profit. Then they start to lay off workers to reduce supply because demand can't keep up with the supply. Then you have the spiral of an economic recession, and it feeds on itself. These things happen and have been happening, it seems like, for the past 200 years, almost every 7 to 10 years. If that's the case, in the last big contraction, economic recession, where we saw the same thing happen, 2007-2008, it would seem like we're on the verge, at least timing-wise, if the past is any sort of indicator of the future. It would seem like we're on the verge of an economic contraction with all of this personal debt. If people lose their jobs, if they can't thus pay the debt, it would seem like the debt holders then risk new bankruptcy. Is that on the horizon?
There's certainly a risk of it. I mean, will it be the same catastrophic sort of collapse that we had in 2008? I think it probably won't be that severe, assuming it happens. But I think the conditions are ripe. I mean, when we think about all that private debt, you know, consumers can't buy the things they want. They have to spend a large portion of their income on interest, which essentially just goes into the pockets of whoever's giving a loan, so basically the banking industry. And so it's this huge bleed on consumers where a good chunk of their income is going regularly into the pockets of financial institutions. But of course, it's all based on the sort of general health of working people. And the reality is, it might get to a point where they won't be able to even pay that. And then, of course, that'll cause huge contractions of the financial industry as suddenly the banks aren't able to become profitable, which is, you know, the most extreme example was in 2008, where banks weren't able to actually have real profit behind all this, you know, speculation and all this debt. So this is certainly a possibility. I think that what we're seeing here is rather than this income being used by working people to kind of buy the things they need and even stimulate the economy by buying, you know, God forbid, some luxuries or some things to make their lives a little more pleasant, all it is just bleeding into the financial services industry, which is just kind of sucking it out like a vampire.
Okay, we have 45 seconds left. I want to ask Steve Keen. Obviously, Trump and the Republicans' tax plan hasn't really kicked in yet, but there was a lot of speculation within Wall Street that there would be a big tax holiday for the corporations, the banks, the ultra-rich. How will this impact on what we anticipate in the coming months?
Well, that'll cause a bit of a boost to aggregate demand. And I don't believe America's in for a crisis, by the way. The crisis will be other countries which continued borrowing their way through the bubble back in 2008. But Trump's tax plan will lead to a bit of a boost to the economy, just from government spending exceeding taxation revenue. But what I expect them to do as well is start cutting back on Social Security at some point, and that'll depress demand on the other side. So they may be in their own undoing in 2019.
Let's okay, we're going to leave anyway. It. We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He's a financial policy analyst, and from Amsterdam by Steve Keen, the author of Debunking Economics and the World's First Crowdfunded Economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/ProfSteveKeen. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
An internal audit of the Defense Logistics Agency by the Big Four accounting firm of Ernst & Young found that the Pentagon failed to keep track of nearly $800 million that it now cannot account for. The auditor said across the board the agency's financial leadership is so weak that it is simply unable to account for its money. We are joined from Washington, D.C., by Dr. Lawrence Korb. He is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information, CDI. He was formerly director of national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, and he was the assistant secretary of defense during the Reagan administration. Dr. Lawrence Korb, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, in some ways, this isn't shocking, but when you lose $800 million, John, it seems shocking to me.
Shocking but not surprising, as the saying goes.
Go ahead, Lawrence.
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind the Defense Department is really the only federal agency that has not been able to be audited. So this is the beginning of the Pentagon being audited, and the Defense Logistics Agency is one of the bigger units in the Pentagon. And the commander of DLA, as they call it, basically said, you know, he's not surprised. You know, this is what they've needed for quite a while. So I think this is a good sign that we're starting this, you know, to audit the Pentagon, and they've started here, you know, with one of the bigger agencies. So hopefully, as it'll go through the rest of the Pentagon, we'll find out about, you know, a lot of the money that we can't account for, and that'll help us to manage whatever money the Congress gives the Pentagon much better. Remember, it was a year ago at this time the Defense Business Board came out and said that they were wasting $25 billion a year with excess, what they call back office space. And what happened is the Pentagon tried to bury it at the time. At least, you know, this has been made public, and the commander has acknowledged the shortcomings.
Dr. Korb, I noticed here in my research that when you were Assistant Secretary of Defense, you had jurisdiction over 70% of the Pentagon's budget. So can you explain to our listeners how the Pentagon goes about accounting for these massive budgets that they have if there's no outside auditor?
Well, basically, you got to remember now, I mean, it's important to keep in mind. For example, now, if you're in the Pentagon today, you are still spending at fiscal year 17 levels, okay, because you don't have a fiscal year 18 budget, even though basically you're three quarters of the way through the fiscal year. You may remember the government did shut down, you know, for, you know, a couple of days here, a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
So here you are trying, you're spending at 17 levels, it's 18, and the Congress is asking you for the fiscal year 19 budget next Monday. So it's not surprising, given all of that, that you can have people not keeping as close track as they should, you know, with the money. I mean, the good thing about the thing with DLA, nobody's accusing the people themselves of, you know, stealing the money or anything like that.
Right. Hasn't disappeared. They just can't account for it yet.
Well, that might mean it. That may mean it's disappeared. If we can't find it,
Well, if we can, and we can, you know, obviously, if there's been any foul play or anything like that, we can do something. The other thing is, don't forget, like, the head of the DLA, Defense Logistics Agency, that the head of that changes every couple of years. I mean, one of the bad things about the military is, you know, they keep rotating so many people. I mean, the civilians stay, but, you know, the commander of this, you know, was just there for probably 3 years.
We know a lot, Lawrence Korb, about the so-called revolving door. It's not just in defense. It's not just in the Defense Department or in the Pentagon. It's in all areas of government where government officials, or in the case of the Pentagon, civilian and uniformed officials of the Pentagon, they rotate out of the public sector and they go to work for some of the same corporations that are getting gargantuan military contracts. And thus, and many of them know at the end of their career, that's exactly what they're going to do. They're going to transfer into the private sector. And thus, there's a lot of research done on how this incentivizes lax oversight or the sort of turning the blind eye towards possible wasteful spending or cost overruns. How big of a factor is that?
Well, it's certainly, and I would say it's almost just the opposite right now. If you take a look at all of the people below Secretary Mattis in the Pentagon right now, the leash, they're all coming from defense industry. So you not only do you have people going out and doing, you're taking a lot of people coming in. Like the Deputy Secretary of Defense is from Boeing. They're one of the big, you know, defense contractors. I got people up there, you know, from Raytheon and a whole bunch of other companies coming in. So to the extent that that's a problem, it's going to get worse given all of the appointees that they've made this time.
Dr. Korb, the big four auditing firms, Ernst & Young, Deloitte & Touche, PricewaterhouseCoopers, and KPMG, are very, very active elsewhere in government. This Ernst & Young audit in the Defense Logistics Agency is a test case, according to Politico. Do you think now with these findings, the big four auditing firms will start to spread out elsewhere around the Pentagon and begin auditing other components?
I sure hope so. And as I say, I was heartened by the comments of, you know, the general that's in charge of the Defense Logistics Agency. Yes, I mean, the Pentagon, you know, they're like almost a decade late to being audited.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
So, yeah, we do need to, particularly at a time when the defense budget is growing quite a bit.
I'm looking, Brian, at an article in Politico today, quoting Chuck Grassley, who's the chairman of the, I mean, he's not the chairman, he's a senior member of the Budget and Finance Committee in the Senate and a Republican senator from Iowa. He says, if you can't follow the money, you aren't going to be able to do an audit. And the article goes on to say that that's essentially true, that when Ernst & Young first began doing this audit, it says they found misstatements in the agency's books totaling at least $465 million for construction projects financed for the Army Corps of Engineers and other agencies. For construction projects designated as still in progress, meanwhile, it didn't have sufficient documentation or any documentation at all for another $384 million worth of spending.
Right. Right.
This is a problem of huge proportions.
Well, it is. And again, with all due respect, I think it's important to keep in mind that when you're working for the Department of Defense and you got to go to war, people say, well, we got to get this done. You know, don't worry about it. We got to make this happen. We got to get the spare parts for the Apache helicopters out there. So, again, it's not surprising that this happens, particularly, you know, we've been at war now for 15 years.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, or maybe sort of perpetually almost since the Korean War, which is when we really made the transition from an economy that had a wartime economy when there were wars to a permanent wartime economy. That started around the time of the Korean War because the U.S. demobilized after World War II. But that which we now know as the military-industrial complex, that which Dwight D. Eisenhower in his farewell address famously warned about the dangers to democracy and dangers in many other parts of society. It's a permanent war economy. And I want to ask you, Dr. Korb, when you look at this, and as you have, because you've been there for a good part of this time and somebody inside of government, How much of the defense budget and defense spending is really based on military needs as outlined or as perceived? And there, of course, there could be big arguments about what that actually means or should be. But how much is it also about economics? How much is it because Dwight D. Eisenhower, in his original draft of that speech, he said it was the military-industrial congressional complex, whereby all sectors of or all parts of the of America and all these congressional districts have some piece of the pie, and thus, as a consequence, everyone's incentivized to keep military spending going at to the detriment, perhaps, or not perhaps, almost certainly, of other parts of the of social spending.
Oh, there's no doubt about the fact that, you know, you're right, quite right. The reason he took congressional out is originally that speech was going to be given before the Congress. So he took it out. Now, obviously, he did not when he gave the speech. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, right now, you've got 20% excess bases, but you can't close them because Congress in 1979 passed a law that said before you close them, you have to give Congress a year's notice. You got to do all these studies. The way around it, which I got done when I was there, you know, Senator Goldwater and I created what now is known as BRAC, because I got so upset and we spoke, I sent him a list of bases we would close if we could. And that led to, you know, the first, you know, base realignment and closure commission. But in 2005, when Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz did it, they didn't do a very good job. And so Congress has not been willing to authorize the BRAC again. But right there is money. And Congress obviously doesn't want to because the bases are obviously in their districts. A lot of times you got to buy particular hardware, you know, planes, ships, tanks, depending not on whether you really need them, but who's making them and what districts they're from. So, I mean, I would say probably you got the defense budget next year is going to be at least, according to what we know, $719 billion, easily $50 billion of that you don't need.
You know, the BRAC program, as Dr. Korb just pointed out, it worked. It actually worked. And local economies were able to transition away from their dependency on these bases and on military spending. It could work in the future, especially when we have so many bases that we don't need. They're just no longer necessary for the kind of military that we have. We can transition those bases into something that actually still continues to benefit the local economy. I don't think, though, that there's much of a stomach in Congress for that kind of thing right now.
Just before you jump in, Dr. Korb, I just want to point out this one fact. The infamous F-35, the hugely expensive military program, every U.S. state but Alaska, Hawaii, Nebraska, and Wyoming has economic ties to the F-35, with 18 states counting on the project for $100 million or more in economic activity, according to primary contractor Lockheed Martin. And this is a deliberate plan, it would seem to me, Dr. Korb, by defense companies to put different parts of the subcontracting businesses with any of these technologies, the F-35 in this case, all over the country, so you have a lot of congressional support for their maintenance, even if those weapons are completely unnecessary or completely victimized, or I don't know what the right word is, suffering from cost overruns of a huge proportion.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, they did that with the B-2 as well, and, you know, they put the subcontract, because then you would get congressional support to keep it going, and when you run into problems with it, like the F-35 has all kinds of problems, that keeps it going. But just to give you an example of what happened, one of the reasons we have a lot of problems with the F-35 today was when they stopped production of the F-22, which was a high-end fighter originally designed to deal with then the Soviet Union threat. When they stopped production of that and at a couple of hundred rather than building 600 or 700, they accelerated the F-35 program, which was not ready to be accelerated. And they did that, you know, to make sure that, you know, your jobs wouldn't suffer in all of these districts.
Let's go to some of the other big spending issues for the Pentagon. Big parts of the budget are actually not in the budget, like the war in Iraq, I believe, was not in the in the budget for a long time.
No, what we've done, and this is a gimmick to get around, you have a Budget Control Act that was passed in 2011, which put a cap on defense spending and non-defense discretionary spending. But the way the Pentagon has gotten around it is they put things in what we call the war funding or the overseas contingency operations budget that have nothing to do with the war. In fact, the comptroller admitted about half of that budget, which next year is going to be supposedly $90 billion, has nothing to do with the wars. So that's one way in which they get around the caps mandated by the Budget Control Act.
I'm looking at the CNBC story, and everybody knows about the story, and Dr. Korb will definitely know about the story. It was from 2011. I want to read a couple paragraphs, very short. New York Fed's $40 billion Iraqi money trail. It's been called the largest airborne transfer of currency in the history of the world, but finding out what happened to all the money involved has become one of the biggest financial mysteries of all time. Beginning in the very earliest days of the war in Iraq, the New York Federal Reserve shipped billions of dollars in physical cash to Baghdad to pay for the reopening of the government and restoration of basic services. The money was packed onto pallets inside a heavily guarded New York Federal Reserve compound in East Rutherford, New Jersey, trucked to Andrews Air Base outside of Washington and flown by military aircraft to Baghdad International Airport. By one account, the New York Fed shipped about $40 billion in cash between 2003 and 2008. And guess what? A big part of the $40 billion, a big part of these cash payments to Iraq, also people don't know, the Pentagon doesn't know or can't account for where that money went. Go ahead, Dr. Korb.
Well, again, and you once you have a war, they also have the Commander's Response Fund, where they allow, you know, the commanders, you know, to give them cash to be able to deal with, you know, things that come up. Yeah, I mean, again, what you were trying to do was get the Iraqi economy up and going and get the government going, and they needed, you know, cash right away. And so what happens in wartime, people don't worry about these things. That's why after that, they put a special inspector general both for Iraq, and we still have one for Afghanistan, to highlight these things. And when what they call them the Seagar would make, you know, these reports, the Pentagon tried to do away with it, you know, to stop them. But the Congress wouldn't let them. The Bush administration tried to disestablish the position. And if you read the one still writing about Afghanistan, he's talked about all the money we can't account for there. And, you know, we go and they look and they say, well, you spent this much money, you know, in this village or stuff. We went in there. We can't see anything.
When I was at the CIA, Brian and Dr. Korb, immediately after the invasion of Afghanistan, we began sending, as an agency, we began sending huge amounts of money out into the field to try to influence, I use with air quotes, influence Afghan warlords. There was an old saying that you can't buy an Afghan warlord, but you can certainly rent one. And the CIA ran into exactly the same problem where you've spent hundreds of millions of dollars. It's all been in cash and it's just simply unaccountable. The money just disappears after a while. Dr. Korb, we speak frequently on this show about the military budget. You know, the Pentagon makes a request of Congress and Congress always appropriates more money than the Pentagon asked for in the first place. If you could advise congressional leaders, what would you tell them about the Pentagon budget?
Well, I would tell them to basically look at all the areas where the money is spent that you don't need and bring it down. Last year when the 18 budget was released, I testified before Senate Armed Services Committee, and I pointed out, you know, how they could easily save $50 billion from what Trump asked for. Rather than doing that, they've added almost 100 to what Trump asked for. And I think, I know it's interesting, it used to be that the Congress would cut, but it's really changed recently that, you know, particularly under Obama and what they had, you know, the House Freedom Caucus, which is worried about the deficit, Congress is trying to add money all the time. Listen, you can't buy perfect defense, no matter how much you spend. You're going to have to make choices. And to the extent that you allow the budget to go up, as it did, people don't make these hard choices. They don't worry about, you know, where the money is going or anything because there's plenty of it there. And if you don't give them incentives, they're not going to make sure that they can pass the audits.
Dr. Korb, let me sort of ask you a big picture question about the function of defense spending in the larger scheme of things. Obviously, a lot of people are feeding at the trough. I mean, you have defense contractors, you have, you know, we can go through the list. A lot of people are getting their bite out of this thing. And of course, tax dollars, it's our tax money that's paying for it. I mean, the money doesn't just come out of thin air. But I want to ask you about the effect of this on this question. In the 1930s, and this is a debate that goes on, and I want to just get your opinion on it. In the 1930s, the economy crashed. Roosevelt introduced, you know, the WPA and other programs to stimulate the economy, kind of a Keynesian approach to prime the pump by government spending. But these were in civilian programs. In 1937, eight years after the first depression, the depression started once again, and the country was still locked into depression in spite of all this government spending. The thing that really got America out of the Great Depression was war spending in World War II. And then after World War II, as I mentioned, the war economy was demobilized, conversion took place, the troops came back home, they went back to their colleges or to their jobs or to their communities. And then there was another kind of severe economic recession in the late 40s, and we went back to a permanent war economy. How big of a factor is military spending as a stabilizer in the economy? In other words, a kind of government intervention to provide subsidies, at least to the corporations and somewhat for jobs and somewhat for some communities, as a stabilizer, something that's not really discussed. In other words, something outside of what is really needed from a military point of view.
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that defense is the least efficient way to stimulate the economy or create jobs. You're quite right. World War II got us out of the Depression. But do you realize we were spending 40% of the gross domestic product, you know, there? I mean, now, you know, defense is like, you know, 3 or 4%. So, I mean, that was just a complete, change in the economy. But if you take a look what happened the last recession that we had, you know, at the last year of the Bush administration when Obama came in, it wasn't defense spending that turned the economy around. It was all of these others. And if you would ask me right now, the best thing you can do for the economy is put the money into infrastructure. That would much more than buying another F-35 or a new nuclear weapon or anything like that. And so if you're looking at it from that point of view, what you need to do is what you need for defense. Go buy it, get the best prices. Hey, you know, you make sure you hold these defense contractors accountable. The F-35, okay, they cost overruns. That doesn't cost Lockheed any money. If you said, hey, if this goes over, you know, you're going to pay. And the real key thing that most people ignore, the best, most important job in the Pentagon is not the secretary, it's the deputy. The Nixon administration, the height of the Cold War, our defense budget in real terms was less than it is now. But the deputy was David Packard, and he bought the 15s or the 16s or the 18s. We still have these planes, and he got them, you know, for the right price. Or even when Dick Cheney was Secretary of Defense at the end of the Cold War, and Don Atwood from General Motors was there, you know, the budget went down, and, you know, we got an awful lot of programs. They canceled all the programs that weren't working.
You know, John, it seems to me one of the issues here is, as long as defense spending is almost a religious article of faith, you have to kind of genuflect before the altar of defense spending in Congress, and they all do. These budgets pass almost unanimously. Trump asked for a certain amount of money for 2018, and I think Congress upped him, you know, like by $40 billion or something. So as long as it's the sacrosanct status of defense spending, it's about whether you defend the country, whether you're there, whether you're a patriot, et cetera, then you have an unfettered You have a situation where the military and the military spending and the military contractors pretty much do whatever they want.
Yeah, I would argue that what Dr. Korb is saying is correct, that it's patriotic to demand of our Congress a first-class infrastructure. We're the United States. We ought to have a first-class infrastructure, the best roads, the best hospitals, the best airports. That also makes our country strong.
Well, we have the best nuclear-armed submarines, though, instead.
Well, you know, with Admiral Moore, or former chairman, Admiral Mullen, the most recent chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said the biggest threat to our national security is the deficit. And that is going skyrocketing. You realize when they did the budget deal 2 weeks ago that extended the government for about a week, they added $31 billion more to the deficit. You put that in, you put the tax cut in, and in a couple of years, that's going to undermine national security.
Dr. Lawrence Korb, let me ask you about the U.S. budget, because you're talking about the deficit. The deficit itself might be the greatest danger to the U.S. government's stability. The U.S. spends in discretionary spending $1.2 trillion every year. Almost half of that, almost half, is spent on defense spending. That's a kind of ratio that doesn't exist in any other modern industrial society. How big of a problem is that, and how big of a problem is it given the fact that the U.S. Congress doesn't talk about it at all, and the media stays almost completely silent, unless there's one of these scandal stories about a missing $800 million. Maybe that's the big story.
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. One, you have very few members of Congress that have been in the military, so they don't want to challenge the general. Some of the other things we talked about here today about the economic impacts of the military budget. But I think a more important figure, we spend more than all the next 10 countries in the world combined on defense. China, Russia, we talk about them. Get them in. So we're spending, it's not a question of spending, needed to spend more. The number that Trump inherited was fine. He shouldn't have been increasing it, but he is. And they're using gimmicks like I mentioned here. The number you gave doesn't even count the war funding account, half of which doesn't go to fighting the wars.
Indeed, that's so true. So it's actually much more than 50% when you include the actual money for war. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined by Dr. Lawrence Korb. He is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, a senior advisor at the Center for Defense Information, CDI. He was formerly director of national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, and he was the assistant secretary of defense during the Reagan administration. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.